My wife, Belva, is named for another Belva, her grandmother, Elliston. By the time I came into the family, Grandma Elliston was already up in years. She had lost an eye and part of her face right next to her eye because of cancer, and she always wore a big bandage there. Grandma Elliston was self-conscious about it, and she rarely appeared in public. But for our part, she was a beautiful and courageous human being, and her home was a favorite gathering place for the entire family, including Belva and me and our children. Sometimes Grandma Elliston apologized for the fact that her house was beginning to look a little shabby. The walls and the woodwork needed a coat of paint. But with all the furniture in there and the huge bookcases lined with her late husband's books and all the stuff that had accumulated in half a century, the job looked like a physical impossibility. In fact, we used to joke about it. We used to say that if we ever cleaned the place out, the axis of the earth would shift. Well, one day, my brother and I decided that we would do it. We would paint Grandma Elliston's dining room and her kitchen. We started early in the morning. We attacked the job like a couple of madmen. We moved everything we could budge out into the living room, and it made a pile practically up to the ceiling. I think we did feel the axis of the earth shift. And then we scraped, and we sanded, and we scrubbed. And when those preparations were done, we put down drop cloths and newspaper, and we began to paint ceiling, walls, woodwork. Grandma Elliston and Aunt Guga pampered us with snacks and lemonade and small talk and plenty of compliments so that we wouldn't run out of energy. And at the end of a couple of exhausting 14 or 15-hour days, almost miraculously, it was done. Two coats of paint from top to bottom, everything back in place, clean as a whistle. I think about those 2 days. I can still see the pile of furniture covered with sheets in the living room, like a snow-capped mountain. I can feel the sweat dripping from my nose and my chin. I smell latex paint. But mostly what I remember was how good it was. The satisfaction of giving this gift to Grandma Elliston. Doing it not because we had to, but just because we felt like it. I remember the incredible closeness I felt with my brother as we worked side by side. The joy of loving and being loved and being a family. It was a celebration. It was one of the happiest times of my life. That's what I remember. But it's interesting. At this same period of time, when we painted Grandma Elliston's dining room and her kitchen, and when we had this wonderful experience of our own goodness, I was a priest in the Episcopal Church. And every Sunday, I led the congregation in hymns and prayers and Bible readings, which were all about how evil, selfish, and sinful we are. We got down on our knees every Sunday morning and we prayed in the language of the Book of Common Prayer. Almighty and most merciful Father, we have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have left undone the things we ought to have done, and we have done the things we ought not to have done, and there is no health in us. But thou, O Lord, have mercy upon us, miserable offenders. I stood at the lectern, and I read Bible stories that were filled with human treachery and sin. I read the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They did the one thing God told them not to do. They ate the forbidden fruit. I read the story of the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. While Moses was up there trembling in his sandals and getting the Ten Commandments, the other folks were down at the bottom of the mountain making themselves a golden bull and dancing and celebrating around it. I read the story of King David and Bathsheba. David placed Bathsheba's husband in the front line of his army where he was sure to be killed. And then after his death, David took Bathsheba for his wife. I read the story of Jesus, how he was betrayed by one of his disciples and died on a cross like a common criminal. In general, Christianity has a low opinion of human motives and intentions. It teaches us that our natural inclinations are not good. In fact, it says that we're not capable of accomplishing anything good by relying on our own powers. If there is any goodness in this world, it must be by God's own doing. Now, of course, that's a religious appraisal of human nature. But it has a lot of support from people who are not particularly religious. The opinion that human beings are basically greedy, violent, and devious is all too consistent with the kind of things we see and hear every day. In our lifetimes, we have seen wars, holocausts, inhumanities on a mind-numbing scale. And all of these horrors are impressive support for those who take a pessimistic view of human nature. Of course, there are other sources of pessimism, too. Ever since Sigmund Freud got the ball rolling, thinkers and writers have been peeling the human onion. Beneath a veneer of rationality and respectability, they've been uncovering our animal natures, our drives and instincts. And people who have never read a word of Freud or any of his successors have bought that kind of thinking. We have all bought it in a way. And we're convinced that if we ever really bared our souls and revealed our truest and deepest selves, it would be a pretty ugly picture. Modern economic thinking, it seems to me, rests on the assumption that human beings are selfish and greedy. Economists take it for granted that we're absolutely insatiable. We can never get enough of the world's luxuries, pleasures, and status symbols. The stock market and all the companies on the big board live by their faith in human greed. Their belief that greed constitutes an inexhaustible reservoir of energy that will drive our market economy forever. Sometimes it seems as if the entire edifice of modern civilization is founded not on goodwill and neighborliness and a desire to help one another, but rather on selfishness, ambition, and greed. Well, I don't think any of us needs to be reminded of the evil that we're capable of, our talent for injuring others, for harming the world around us, and even for doing things that are self-destructive. But I must say that in spite of that, I believe that our desire to be good and to do good are far deeper and more powerful motivating forces than all of these negative drives. I believe that the desire to build is stronger than the desire to destroy, in spite of my dad's work on the garage. I believe that the desire to bring people together is stronger than the desire to drive us apart. And I believe that desire to comfort is stronger than the desire to cause pain. I believe we have a hunger for goodness. In fact, I think it's kind of ironic that it's this urge, this drive, that we tend to deny and cover up and conceal from others. It's almost as if Freud had it backwards, that it's not the darkness inside us that we're sort of suppressing, but the light that might otherwise radiate from us. Had my brother and I defaced Grandma Elliston's property and taken advantage of the fact that she was an old woman with one eye and assaulted her, it would have been in all the newspapers. But instigating and perpetrating a good deed was not news. I'll tell you, I don't get it. I remember from my days in the church how good we used to feel about confessing how evil we were, as if there were something blessed and holy in bad-mouthing and belittling ourselves. Well, I've lost my taste for it. I think it's better for us, frankly, to feel good about being good. Far healthier to remind ourselves of all the goodness and goodwill we have, and far more constructive to give the goodness that's in us a little more breathing room. I once served on a committee with a man who constantly raised objections to absolutely everything anybody else had to say. He was a royal pain, and nobody in the group had much use for him. We all had the impression he was just grandstanding, trying to show everybody just how brilliant he was. Well, I went to one meeting where he just carried this a step too far, and everybody ganged up on him and let him have it. It was absolutely brutal. I knew he had it coming, and I still felt sorry for him. Afterwards, I went out to lunch with him, and as we waited for our orders to come, I told him I was sorry about what had happened. "You weren't trying to start World War III," I said to him. "You just want to be recognized. You want to be included." And he agreed. "The problem is," he said, "I'm not very good at it. What I am good at is getting everybody riled up and painting myself into a corner." He was speaking with an honesty and unpretentiousness I had never heard from him before. I was moved. It brought tears to my eyes. "You know," I said, and I was looking right at him, "I think there's a very good human being in there, a much better human being than any of us has noticed." And then this man, who had always intellectualized everything, put his hand on my arm and wept. I can't tell you how often I've had to do just that as a counselor, remind people of their own goodness. As a minister and a counselor, I am so aware of how little I can do for people. In the end, people have to solve their own problems, make their own decisions, take their own initiatives. I can help sort out opinions maybe a little bit and give them a little encouragement, but they're the ones who have to do it. But in spite of these limitations, the one thing I can do is I can help them believe in their own goodness. And it's an amazing what a meaningful and effective and powerful thing that is. Just helping them see that they're capable of helping themselves. And more than that, helping them to believe that they're worthy of doing good things for themselves and actually being happy. That they're not on this earth to suffer for all their sins. They are good human beings and they actually deserve to be happy. It is a role reversal from what I used to do as an Episcopal priest. I've gone from reminding everybody how evil and sinful we are so that we'll turn our lives over to God, to proclaiming human goodness and worth so that people will dedicate themselves to achieving their true potential. It's an amazing role when you think about it, helping people mobilize their own goodness. Now, of course, when you start helping people believe in their own goodness, this is not just a warm and fuzzy feel-good exercise. It means opening eyes to things that can be done and things that need to be done. It means waking up to the power that we have to make a difference in the world. You cannot discover your own goodness and remain a moral couch potato. A whole new world of obligations and opportunities opens up. I believe that frustrated goodness is a major source of unhappiness and discontent. People who are pretty well off, who have nice homes and cars and plenty of things, feel empty and alienated and disappointed in life and can't figure out what's wrong with them. And what's the problem? This is often what the problem is. It's an unsatisfied need to do good for others, an unfulfilled desire to work for positive things, positive change. In material terms, they have what they need, but they have this repressed moral hunger. Now, I realize I've been standing up here using the term goodness without defining my terms. This is a no-no in ethical culture to do that. You know, I'm sort of circling around my term, and I haven't put my finger on exactly what it is. And I've been doing it for a good reason, and that's because I'm not sure I can. It's a very difficult thing to get at. I think our understanding of goodness and our knowledge of goodness unfolds in this way as we explore our experience with it. As I think about it, goodness is a quality of caring that leads us to reach out and do things that go beyond satisfying our own wants and needs. It is a way of being more alive that connects us with the needs of others and the condition of the world. Goodness is having a generous heart and uninhibited loving reflexes. Goodness overlaps what we mean when we speak of being moral, but it's not exactly that. By being moral, we generally mean conforming with certain expectations and standards of human behavior. For the most part, I think goodness meets these standards and expectations, but it's not driven by them. Goodness is opportunistic, creative, idiosyncratic. It has its own motives. It does more than morality expects and requires. It does the unexpected. It goes overboard. Goodness overlaps what we mean by civility, if I can refer to a summer discussion that we had. Civility, to me, mostly means being polite and considerate, and surely we can use more of that these days in the era of traffic jams and long lines at the airports and bureaucratic runarounds and cell phones on at theaters and concerts and restaurants. But there's a lot more to goodness than just being polite and considerate. To a large extent, good manners revolve around restraint and self-control and not giving offense. But goodness is not restrained. It means genuinely caring. It means seeing and hearing and reaching out, taking time, going the extra mile. Goodness is energetic, irrepressible, contagious. Generally, when people ask us to behave morally and decently, they are asking us to control our emotions and keep our feelings reined in. But I believe that goodness begins with a capacity for feeling, being in touch with our own feelings, our own pleasure and pain, our joy and suffering, and then drawing on that to be connected with other people, other human beings, other sentient feeling creatures. Yeah, there are times when we need to control our emotions, times when we have to do it. But mostly, I think, we need to open up to them. I think they are the real source of human goodness. Belva and I have two granddaughters. The older one is 12 now, believe it or not. She was born when I was here the first time. Her name is Maria. You may remember that she was born prematurely. And as a result of that, she has some very serious health problems and handicaps. Very hard of hearing. She's legally deaf. But all her life, Maria has impressed me as someone who's in touch with her own feelings and in touch with the feelings of others. When Maria was just 2, going on 3, she was hospitalized with pneumonia, the kind of thing that happened all too often with her. Well, every now and then a nurse would come into her room, and you know what they do? She pounded on Maria's back. Of course, it made Maria cough, and she didn't like it, but this is part of the treatment. It's a way of breaking up the congestion in her lungs. Well, Belva and I visited Maria in the hospital at that time. And while we were there talking with her and playing with her, a nurse came in the room and began to pound on her roommate's back. A little girl with cystic fibrosis is what we think we remember. Well, Maria stood up in her crib and called out at the nurse, "Don't hurt her. Don't hurt her." And Belva and I walked out of that hospital just shaking our heads, a 2-year-old. We will never forget it. A few years ago, when Maria was in 3rd grade and her younger sister Kayla was in 2nd grade, I visited the school because I was a storyteller in the 2nd grade classroom, in Kayla's classroom. And then after the story, a big deal, I had lunch with Kayla and her classmates. Well, as we were finishing up our lunch, over comes Maria from the area where her class sat. And she comes over and she gives Kayla a hug and me a hug. And then a girl that was sitting across the table said to me, "You know, she does that every day." I said, "You mean she gives her sister a hug every day?" And she said, "Yep, every day." Of course, Maria is just a kid, and we know she can get bent out of shape like any other kid, but there is really something special about her. There's a story in the New Testament about a time when Jesus' disciples were arguing about which one deserved the highest rank among Jesus' followers. And Jesus placed a child in front of them. And he said, "He who becomes like this child is the greatest." Well, I've decided that when I grow up, I want to be as loving and good as Maria is. Good people are capable of generosity and sacrifice, but I never want to give the impression that it is totally selfless and unselfish. That would be a lie. When my brother and I painted Grandma Ellison's dining room and kitchen, it was not a totally unselfish act. Little kids saying, "Can I help? Can I help?" You know? We were like little children, trying to please our parents. Afterwards, we sat down to celebrate at one of Grandma Ellison's home-cooked meals. And now she was trying her best to please us. We were giving and receiving, taking in exchange, as is part of any loving relationship. And as is part of any loving relationship, it was impossible to say just who was the giver and the recipient at any point. That's my understanding of goodness. Simple, powerful, fulfilling. Of course, it raises a question. If goodness is so simple and there's such a hunger for it, why is there so much evil in the world? And why do people seem to lose touch with this basic drive? Well, the religion I grew up with had a simple answer. The answer was God. We have cut ourselves off from God, and by turning away from God, we've cut ourselves off from the good life we were meant to live. Therefore, we are not good, and we have all fallen under the power of evil. But that's kind of a stock answer, and I think the real answer is a lot grittier and more down to earth. I think bad things happen to our hunger for goodness because, amazingly enough, it is so often attacked and belittled, because it's not allowed to grow and express itself, and because these assaults on our goodness begin very early in life, and they go on day after day. In the last 20 to 25 years, there's been an enormous increase in our awareness of child abuse, kids who are physically, sexually, emotionally abused by parents and other adults around them. I think the last time I looked, there were something like 3 million reported cases of child abuse annually in this country. And the violence that's inflicted on kids, and the neglect, and the abuse of all sorts that happens to kids is enough to turn your stomach. But it's not just an attack on their physical and emotional well-being. It is an attack on their goodness and the lifelong potential of that goodness. I'm convinced that one of the most destructive things we can do to children is to put them down and to depreciate that quality and to make them feel not good, worthless, instead of affirming their innate hunger for goodness to send messages, repeated messages, that they're bad. Maybe this was supposed to happen, but while I was working on this talk, I was sitting at a carrel in a public library, and there was a little boy in there, a three-year-old, who saw me in this sort of corner of the library and kept peeking around the corner at me. And that wasn't enough, so he began turning the lights off and on, switching the lights off. I mean, nothing malicious. He was just testing, exploring, experiment, being a three-year-old. Suddenly, his mother comes in there, grabs him by the arm, and takes him into a bathroom where she can spank him and scold him where nobody can see them. Except I'm sitting outside the door and I can hear everything. And what she's doing is yelling at the top of her lungs to him, "You are bad, bad, bad." And each time she said the word bad, she hit him. Obviously, she was trying to scold the bad out of him, but she was doing exactly the opposite. She was scolding it into him. It is amazing how our society conspires to starve, injure, and violate our drive for goodness. And how kids can play a role, parents can play a role, schools, everything can come together. And then to top it all off, we bring up God, and we back it all up in the name of God. At the present time, there are some very dangerous alliances in the world between secular and religious forces that are obsessed with evil and have this supposed divine mission to destroy evil. I sometimes puzzle over this. What is it that brings religious conservatives, with their concern about America's moral condition, what do they have in common with cynical and worldly? How did this coalition come together? What is it that holds this stuff together? Well, I think this is part of their common ground, a belief that people are essentially evil and that it's foolish and naive to think otherwise or to apply another kind of thinking to problem solving. It is a very unfavorable environment for those who believe in goodness, those who favor human goodness and believe that it has a power to change the world that military and economic might will never achieve. The people in ethical societies, believe it or not, are people of faith. Ours is a faith in human goodness and what that goodness can accomplish. It is interesting to me that people who are capable of believing in souls, spirits, divine miracles, and heaven find a belief in human goodness too much of a stretch for them. They cannot seem to grasp what a potentially practical and powerful faith this is. An ethical society is a school for goodness. It is where we recognize and celebrate this basic human need, our hunger for goodness. It is where we struggle to liberate the goodness that's in us from the abuse and disparagement it has suffered in the course of our lives. It is where we work on rediscovering and embracing our own goodness with a childlike simplicity.